All right, everybody. Welcome to our panel today, focused on tariffs, trade, Trump, and some reshoring conversation as well. Right here at the top, this panel is sponsored by Tama ETFs, who manage the American Reshoring ETF, ticker RSHO. As we will be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different, so you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this space should be construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivatives. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, those of you who have attended these panels before know how much I like the open conversation amongst our panelists, so feel free to chime in, add your two cents to any given topic. The only request I have is that we keep all microphones muted until after the prior speaker is finished so we can rule out any overlap. Now, with that said, let's start off with introductions for our panelists today. Well, starting off here with Yuri Kojamirian, the CIO of Tama ETFs, today's sponsor. Yuri has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios alike, and even co-managed the Magity Fund, where he raised several billion dollars in assets. And in previous panels, I've always been a massive fan of Yuri's professional takes and his input. So as always, Yuri, thanks for coming and thank you for sponsoring today's panel.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Up next, we've got Marko Bjegovic, the founder and CEO of Arquamino Research, where he provides in-depth research on U.S. macroeconomics and markets as a whole. Marko has nearly two decades of experience working in the markets as an equity broker, investment advisor, manager, even the chief bank macroeconomist. Marco's forecasts and analysis help educate and inform investors all over the world, and we're glad to have him joining us. Welcome, Marko.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here again.
Next, we've got Brent Johnson, over 20 years of experience in the financial markets, ranging from managing director at Baker Avenue Asset Management to the CEO of Santiago Capital, managing hundreds of millions in assets. Brent frequently does interviews and speaks at conferences on a wide array of topics, from metals to macroecon and currencies. Happy to have you here as well today. Welcome back, Brent.
Thank you for the invite. Looking forward to it.
Next, we've got Adam Ozimek, a chief economist at Economic Innovation Group, serving on the executive team and leading an ever-growing font of research. He's also served as chief economist at Upwork and senior economist at Moody's. His research has been cited nearly everywhere, from the Wall Street Journal to New York Times. Thanks for joining us today, Adam. Excited for your takes, man.
Thank you. I was glad to be here.
And we've got Professor Ben Galoob, an economics professor and researcher at Northwestern University. He specializes on social and economic networks, public goods, and social learning. He's published myriad works ranging from organizational fragility and corporate culture to supply network formation, public good, and the socioeconomic relationships therein. I'm looking forward to your takes on my questions today, Ben. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, a ton has transpired in the arena of tariffs since we last got together to speak specifically on this topic with you all. Of course, Trump has confirmed that intent to levy 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, with 10% on China, as well as a potential 10% on the European Union. He's also doubled down on that, stating that any retaliation, which we'll also get to during the panel, will be met with even steeper tariffs. Although, as of yesterday, Trump and Trudeau have said that the Canada-US tariffs are paused for at least 30 days. But Yuri, on our last panel sponsored by Tama's RSHO ETF, the prospect of tariffs was very much up in the air. Since then, though, especially over this past weekend into yesterday, that up-in-the-air status seems to be tightening up a little bit, with the likelihood of incorporating tariffs on the rise, seemingly rapidly. So to start us off, Yuri, given that we're smack dab in the middle of earnings season, what are companies saying and looking at in regards to the tariff situation?
Thanks very much. Look, I think the situation was always going to be fluid pretty much since the election. After Trump's election, we knew that this idea of universal tariffs, anywhere between 10 and 20% was being floated around, with specific large tariffs on China. Then there was a bit of a spat with Mexico to begin with, and Canada. And obviously we've had that flare up again this week, postponed again by a month. So, and between that then and now, you've also had this sort of conversation about the potential of gradually introducing tariffs. I think the idea there is you sort of ratchet them up to 2% maybe every month to achieve your specific goals. And that, I guess the idea there is it gives clarity and kind of ratchet up the pressure. And then there were sort of leaks about targeted tariffs and all kinds of things. And I think the reality is that there is some walking back from harsh tariffs, but I think it was a big campaign promise for Trump. And most of the companies we speak to are pretty much laboring under the assumption that it's going to happen. And what's quite interesting is that most of the companies also had experiences under the first Trump administration in terms of quite, you know, unpredictable and uncertain policy. And so a lot of them have got used to this idea that tariffs might come in and they have to readjust their businesses. As we all know, the reshoring trend has been strengthening over the last couple of years, helped by both the Biden-Harris administration and then also under Trump. And many of the companies have already been making moves to essentially move production to the United States. And that is a way of protecting against tariffs. And so what the businesses that we speak to are basically saying, look, either we've already made plans or have production facilities in the US. So if you take a company like ABB, Swiss leader in transformers, basically has a massive presence in the US. They reckon by now they're 85 to 90% sourcing from the US for all of their major components that they need to manufacture and manufacturing in the US. So that kind of trend has been ongoing for a while. So a lot of companies are kind of ready for it. And then the second bit is that many of the companies, they've got the right tools to deal with tariffs. So they tell us that, you know, we've got pricing action that we can take. We can react quite quickly in our supply chain. We've aligned our suppliers and our contracts to be able to react to the situation. And so what that will tell a lot of the economists on the call is a lot of this will get priced in quickly by the companies themselves. Many of them will have clauses in contracts that they can pass this on quite quickly. And so the hit to consumers could happen instantly in a way. And that leaves a lot of question marks for economists about the impact on the economy. Equally, we need to understand some of the offsets, right? Things like this will raise revenues. What will those be used for? This will likely push the US dollar up against trading currencies. Is that going to be an offset? And what is the actual nature of these policies going to look like? Because even though we've had a lot of headlines, we actually still don't know how these tariffs will happen. And so where we sit today is, what I always kind of think about is, what's the one constant from the companies that we talk to, the macroeconomic picture? It's difficult to know how all of these things will play out. But the constant is every company you speak to is saying, I need to be moving more manufacturing to the US to protect against this. And previously, maybe policies like, or strategies like nearshoring, so moving production to Mexico, was seen as a viable strategy for a business because it was still lower cost, but it was closer to the US market. That, as we've seen, and there are other risks involved in that strategy, is going to be more and more difficult if there are going to be tariffs placed on that border. And so what we're seeing is that that's the solution. And there was a Bain & Company survey very recently that said, well, maybe a couple of years ago, 63% of companies were planning to move and reshore manufacturing to the US. Now the number is 81%, and only 2% of the companies said that they've completed their reshoring plans. So there's still a lot to go in terms of building this kind of rebuilding this US manufacturing base to react to this policy. And that's the one constant that we see companies talk about, and everything else, frankly, has just been macroeconomic speculation, which can be quite difficult to pin down.
So you mentioned there on the nearshoring versus reshoring argument. Back in October, Chris Semenuk wrote on Tema about nearshoring versus reshoring. And with the current administration's stance on tariffs and, you know, potentially reciprocated by our trade partners, the premise that reshoring is more beneficial than nearshoring may have even more context. So could you just real quick for the listeners, walk us through those differences between nearshoring and reshoring and what risks with nearshoring may not be as prevalent for companies focused on reshoring here within the U.S.?
Obviously, supply chains are a very complex decision for a company. And in many ways, the world has moved towards globalization. And so supply chains can be stretched around the world. As the world became more and more protectionist, and I think the one thing that's important is that that turn probably happened about 15 years ago. There's a great paper that starts to look at when America started to look at protectionism as a tool, and they identify 15 years ago as the point where that happened. And usually that means that processes that started 15 years ago are probably going to continue for quite a while because they're ingrained in institutional mindsets and policy making. But companies are trying to react to this world. What they see is a lot of, they have to assess cost and risk. And if you're a manager and you're thinking about where to build supply chain and build factories, what you're probably used to think is cost-dominated risk. So yes, sure, supply chains are stretched around the world, but everyone's doing it and the risk is low and the cost advantage is there. Now, faced with uncertain supply chains, and it's not just trade policy, it's wars, the disruptions in the Red Sea that we've seen, droughts in the Panama Canal, strikes at ports. Supply chains are a lot riskier, and COVID is really the example that kind of woke a lot of managers up. You could make the decision moving your manufacturing to somewhere close by, like Mexico, and of course you still have the cost advantage. And the calculus there was, in our view, always a little bit precarious, not just because of the potential of tariff threat, but if you are a manager, you needed to look at a few corporate examples of U.S. companies setting up production in Mexico and some problems they've run into politically. The political situation in Mexico has changed considerably under AMLO, and there are definitely some risks in terms of expropriation. For example, a U.S. company called Vulcan Materials had a quarry and a port expropriated in Mexico. There's a couple of European companies that have had manufacturing facilities that they built expropriated. There was a small railway that was expropriated as well. All of these projects in terms of serving projects for the government there. So there were already some political risks. And then the tariff picture for us was always a bit strange because, one, there was a chance that Trump was going to get in, but also, as we all know, the successor to NAFTA is up for review in 2026. So you're already heading into a potential negotiation situation. And so a company might place their manufacturing facility in Mexico and actually kind of rue the day. Now, I don't know how these things will play out because the border is very complicated in the sense that what do some companies tell us? And, I was on the call of a big railway company that moves goods between the borders, that they say, actually, product moves over the border several times. So car manufacturing, for example, can involve the movement of that particular vehicle over the border several times. So what's going to happen? Is that going to, if there's countervailing tariffs on the other side, is that going to get tariffs on it a few times? So it's a very complicated situation. But generally, if you're a company now and you're seeing the situation, you're probably going to think about U.S. manufacturing. Now, the cost is higher, but there are subsidies in place. And also, if you start to think about automation and investing in future-proof technologies, the cost advantage is not as big as it used to be. And I think that's the fundamental decision that's pushing. So if you take cost and is not as bad and the risks are there, that's probably the decision you're going to make. That's what we see on the ground.
Thank you, Yuri. So I do want to go back to something Yuri said during his breakdown there, and that being the tie between all of the situation and the U.S. dollar. So some analysts do predict that steep tariffs could strengthen the U.S. dollar while also driving up those prices for imported goods and potentially causing inflation. Marco, could you kind of break down that notion that these tariffs could be inflationary and what kind of risks might be tied to that?
Okay, so I'm going to repeat something that I've already said other Twitter spaces that you organized, and this is that I don't think that tariffs are actually going to be inflationary. I think that they are going to raise prices. Like you will, I don't know, if you get 25% tariffs for the goods coming from Canada and Mexico, they will most probably cost 25% more. But that doesn't mean that inflation will go up, because for inflation we would need to see something like, okay, 25% now, and then I don't know, 5% again, and then 10% again, and so on. There should be some consecutive tariff hikes in order for inflation to show up. So this is something like people have been talking about prices in terms of inflation. I mean, they have been equating prices with inflation, but when we actually talk about inflation, we mean that inflation is a change in prices over some period, usually 1 year. And if we only see just one-time price adjustment, this will not actually lift inflation. And this is what actually I'm expecting to see from these tariffs. But I don't know. For now, it seems like that these tariffs could be a negotiating tool. So we don't actually know what will happen. We all thought that that there will be 25% tariffs on goods coming from Mexico and Canada. They were supposed to be introduced today, but as you all know, they were postponed for another 30 days. So we don't know what will happen in these 30 days. Maybe they get postponed again. Maybe, I don't know, maybe they get slashed. Maybe they get increased. We don't know. We just need to see what happens. But so far, it seems like President Trump is actually using these tariffs as a negotiating tool, just to get something. I don't know. Maybe that's not really clear what he's trying to get at first, because he was telling things like, okay, I want to decrease drug trafficking from Canada, which obviously, it probably is an issue to some point. To some extent, but actually, that's probably not the main issue that exists between the US and Canada. So this was probably some kind of an excuse to get something else. What exactly we'll probably need to see in the following weeks.
You brought up a really good point there, Marco, and I wanna dive down this hole just a little bit here. Some critics of this whole tariff situation have said that this recent clash with Canada fit the bill of what they call dangerous theatrics, pointing to the fact that Canada announced pretty much all of the plans outlined in this deal back in December. So, Adam, I'm curious, what are your thoughts here? Was there any gain on either side of the border from this situation this weekend extending into yesterday?
No gain, but costs. Both Canada and Mexico mostly did previously announcing that they were going to do. And this isn't the first time that President Trump has claimed, we've solved the problem. Before he had, in, I think 2019, he had said, well, we got Mexico to put 20,000 troops on the border. Problem solved. Now it's 10,000 troops. So apparently we've solved the problem with even fewer troops than last time. So no, I don't think we got anything from it. And I think it's important to understand that this has long-run implications that are negative for U.S. manufacturers. So I hear all this talk about reshoring. I think what people need to think about is the decision to reshore is very often a decision to reshore in North America. And in some cases in, North and South America, what we have is regional trade, what some economists call factory North America. And if you look at the auto industry, goods and equipment and machines go back and forth over the northern and southern borders over and over again. As changes are made, things are added, and that helps overall North American auto industry manufacturing be more competitive with the rest of the world. And so when you throw sand into these gears by raising uncertainty costs, you make investing in North America look worse. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of people who are like, oh, we were going to do a factory in Mexico, we'll do it in the United States instead now. Instead, they're going to be like, oh, we were going to do a factory in Mexico and maybe have some production in the US as well, but instead we're going to do it in Asia. We're going to do it in India. We're going to do it somewhere else. That's the primary margin of competition that I think we're... You want a strong, integrated North American manufacturing zone with lots of specialization and gains from trade and doing things efficiently. And that's the story of the U.S. auto industry. If it wasn't for Mexico and Canada contributing to U.S. auto industry production, we'd probably have fewer auto industry jobs in the U.S. losing out to imports over time. So this is just a fundamental story of how manufacturing works in a globalized economy. And this idea of winning by throwing sand into the gears of North American trade is it's backwards. It's going to hurt us. And even if things get pulled down quickly after fake negotiations and fake victories, those things have cost because they make people more concerned about investing in the future. They undermine the concept of the continental free trade, one of the advantages of manufacturing here. So it's bad. It's bad. We get nothing from it.
If I can, you, Adam, you done?
Yes.
I just wanted to jump in there and on that issue. With it was Yuri briefly mentioned it in his take, which was about goods crossing the border multiple times, and that's really, I mean, two points that it seems to be extremely poorly thought out. This aspect of it, it's hard to get a straight. I mean, most people who focus on this think it's ad valorem taxes that are going to hit goods every time they cross the border. I think it is a fantasy that you can, with the sort of reshoring plans companies are making, that they're going to be that they're going to mostly, you know, that's a good way to avoid the harm of these tariffs, because except for a very few of the largest and most integrated, kind of vertically integrated, Japan-style conglomerates, a lot of the costs of these tariffs are going to be in your suppliers having to bear the cost of their inputs, you know, crossing all these borders multiple times. So the idea that businesses are going to look at this stuff and think, oh, what a great time for us to invest so we don't get, you know, pay for these tariffs by bringing, you know, our one operation onshore, or a few of them, it just completely misses the systemic nature of this thing, which is that if you really do poorly thought out untargeted tariffs that hit border crossings, you know, every time it happens, it really just, as Adam said, makes North America an unattractive place to do business, period. It just means the US can be a consumer market, and you get hit with that import tariff once, you know, assuming you can't find a way to bribe your way out of it. And so I think this idea that this is somehow, you know, businesses can handle this with good strategy, I mean, yeah, they're going to try to do stuff, but I think the big story is just the secular shift that's going to happen away from manufacturing. And I think that's kind of the most economically interesting thing about it.
Thank you, Ben. Brent, did you have anything to add to Adam and Ben's points there before we move us along?
To be honest, I would take the other side of those arguments. I think the idea that the U.S. got nothing out of this is completely wrong. I don't know exactly, you know, what the terms that Trump was asking for. And, you know, the idea that, you know, we asked for 20,000 troops a year ago or 5 years ago, and now it's down to 10. If there was actually 20,000 Mexican troops on the border trying to keep illegals from coming into the United States, then you wouldn't have seen the huge drop off that we've seen since Trump got into office. And with regard to Canada, if they already had all this stuff in place, then why have the increase in people coming over illegally and the fentanyls? Why is that picked up? So I think by Trump laying down a firm date and saying this is going to happen, it spurred things to happen quicker. Now, we've got 30 days to find out whether or not Canada and Mexico will follow through. But does anybody really believe if Canada and Mexico do not follow through that Trump is just going to say, okay, no problem? So again, I think too many people are looking at this stuff from an economic standpoint, and I'm the first to admit that from an economic standpoint, this is going to cause volatility, it's going to cause problems, it's going to cause uncertainty. But you know what? This is Trump doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And so for anybody to be surprised by it, I think is a little silly. And then second of all, you know, the U.S. has done business a certain way for the last 30 or 40 years. And Trump has come in and said, we're going to dramatically change the way that we do business. Even under the best circumstances, that is going to cause volatility. And if the way business has been done the last 30 or 40 years has been so great, and we should continue doing it that way as opposed to the way Trump wants to do business, then why is the U.S. in the position that it's in? Why do we have, this economic problems that we're trying to solve? So, you know,
what are those problems?
On whether or not the U.S. got nothing and Canada and Mexico got everything. And, you know, the idea that companies are going to start moving plants to Asia rather than Mexico or the U.S. because Trump's a mean guy, I think is wrong. So, again, I'm happy to, stand back now and kind of listen to the responses, but I think that's provably incorrect.
Yeah, can I respond to that?
Sure.
Let's go Adam, then Ben.
Okay. So, first off, 2024, there were 43 pounds of fentanyl that came caught coming over the Canadian border. It's not an issue there. Like, that's not what this is about.
Do you have any friends that have died from fentanyl?
That doesn't change the facts. 43 pounds compared to 21,000 pounds coming over Mexico.
Let's make sure we're going one at a time here. We're going to cause too much feedback for the listeners.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the more important the issue it is, the more important it is to deal in facts. And the fact is that Canada is not a source of fentanyl. It's coming from the Mexican border. So, and again, you know, Trump says, I don't really have an ask for these countries. He literally said, you know, just before the deal was made, there's nothing they can do to stop the deal. Okay, so it's bluster. But the idea that you have to respond to the actual issues here, right? There's no fentanyl coming over the Canadian border, one. Second, it's not about Trump being mean, okay? That's like a complete straw man. It's about the impact of threatening tariffs and undermining the free movement of goods by manufacturers across borders in North America, reducing investment and expansion in America. You can't on the one hand say that we've had this devastating loss of manufacturing jobs to Asia, but on the other hand simply dismiss that new taxes on domestic production aren't going to, on the margin, push more production over there. Right. It's you can't have it both ways. Like, if it's a problem that a lot of it's happened, then you have to be concerned that more of it's going to happen on the margin. This is bad policy to increase production. It undermines that goal. So let's try to keep this as fact based as we can, I think, and not like repeat political talking points on either side here. I think that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I would echo that. You mind if I jump in quickly?
Please, yeah.
I think we're talking about supply chains, not fentanyl. I'm not an expert on fentanyl, but I do know people who have lost loved ones to that, you know, to fentanyl and drugs, and they are not interested in bluster against Canada, because as Adam said, you want to focus on the real problems. I completely buy that Trump has a compelling political package for his base, and I don't think any of us are really experts into a lot of other Americans. We're not experts in that. I think the impact on the economy is interesting, and I think the idea. I think I'd put it this simply: I don't know of a single person who's specialized expertise is understanding impact on, you know, trade and complex supply chains, who thinks an untargeted 25% tariff on our North American trade partners is good for American manufacturing. I don't even know anyone, I don't know how to define it, like with a PhD whose job is to analyze these markets, who thinks that's a smart policy to achieve that goal. If somebody can bring such a person's, you know, cite such a thing, that would already be interesting. I think everybody agrees it's kind of some kind of confusing threat. Maybe there'll be carve outs, but the idea, I just want to make sure we're all agreed in the space that it's not by any means a reasonable economic policy to achieve the stated goal, to achieve anything good for American manufacturing. And then, you know, what if we're not agreed on that, we should decide. If we are agreed on that, we can move to sort of what are the implications for business and the macroeconomy.
I'm not agreed on that.
And what's the evidence? What's the research that you would cite to back up that view?
I would cite the fact that what you guys are suggesting is continuing to do the same thing that we've done for a long time, and the manufacturing jobs in the United States are nil. That's the facts I would state.
That's not research. That's a political talking point, right? We try to understand.
So at the risk of getting derailed, I do want to keep things moving along here smoothly. And I want to go back a little bit just to that broader topic of geopolitics, one side versus the other, notwithstanding. I do want to stay on task a little. So Yuri, I wanted to ask you here, is the whole tariff situation here in some ways a case of geopolitics redrawing those traditional sector and geographic lines of investing? And if so, how is RSHO monitoring that situation for a smooth transition with investments? Oh, try that again there, Yuri. Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was just clicking on the mic. Look, I think if we take a step back from kind of the economic picture on whether these policies specifically work or don't work, I think the trajectory is definitely to build more factories in America. And I think in terms of like an investment perspective, as we all know, the way kind of classic investing is done is lines are drawn across sectors, across geographies. But I think what's happening in the way the world is transitioning over the last sort of 5-10 years is, if you think about a particular sector or you think about a geography, can you for certainty say that this company belongs to that particular country or geography? Just because a company is domiciled in the United States, does that mean that that company necessarily benefits and operates from all of its policies? Equally, a company that might be listed in another country could have all of its operations in the US. And what we're seeing here is that a lot of this geopolitical conflict, as it heats up, is redrawing those lines, that the relative winners and losers are no longer going to be defined by saying, I'm just going to invest in US firms, because there's going to be a group of US firms that will benefit from this and other groups of firms that are not going to benefit from those. And that's partly how our fund is structured and the way we sort of look at the world. And equally how we look at the world at Tema, we're trying to think that sector and geographic lines are no longer the relevant metric, that they're sort of backward looking definitions of how the world is progressing. And you have to be kind of thinking about what are the core forces that are reshaping the way the economy looks and will look in the next 10 years. Now, whether a lot of these polls will succeed or not, I think one of the most important things that we see in reshoring, and I kind of alluded that to it at the beginning, is companies are making these decisions already. They have been, and they see a lot of risks. And a lot of companies we talk to, they just don't want, managers don't want to be fired by boards for not having resilient supply chains. These are going to be economic decisions. There's definitely going to be some influence from policy. But what most of the managers that we speak to see is just an uncertain world. I mean, even Jamie Dimon in his latest annual report basically said he sees the world as the most uncertain it's been since the Second World War. And now, of course, it's easy to say the word uncertainty in investing. And our job is really to try to think of what are the certainties. And one of them is just this redrawing of these lines. And one of the things that we encourage investors to think about is is investing in an industrial sector or investing in US companies, is that really an easy way to kind of draw the lines. And are you actually on the right side of some of these trends? Reshoring is very much at the heart of this. Businesses are moving manufacturing to the US. They are thinking about the risks they see in the world. And that is kind of one of the ways the economy is going to be restructured and why you want to invest against that. Buying just an industrials fund or focusing on US companies, domestic companies or mid caps is probably not the right way to get exposure to this.
Thank you, Yuri. Does anyone have any comments to that?
Well, while we're on the topic of the geopolitics of it all, I don't think you can possibly remove geopolitical implications from the tariffs. I think it's all related. And I think those who look at the tariffs and analyze them specifically on economic terms, rather than other national security concerns, geopolitical concerns, other, whether it's military or trade type alliances, I think it's all related. And to be clear, this isn't some 3D chess move that Trump came up with. This is the opposite of a 3D chess move. This is him telling you exactly what he's going to do and trying to do it. Now, I don't know whether he's going to be successful or not, but what I do know is that the U.S. consumer market, which often gets downplayed as a liability, is actually a great asset and a weapon that can be wielded against the rest of the world who exports into it. And if Trump can use the U.S. consumer market to his advantage to get other national security concerns or geopolitical concerns solved quicker, then I think that's what he's going to do. And so I think those who analyze the tariffs specifically and strictly from an economic perspective are kind of missing the bigger picture.
So I want to touch on that actually. And Ben, I'll give you a chance to respond to that kind of within this same question. I want to touch a little bit on that American consumer impact here, just a touch. Food economist David Ortega highlighted that these proposed tariffs could significantly drive up grocery costs, which would also disproportionately affect lower income households in the United States. So I'm curious, how could people and possibly policymakers mitigate this potential rise in food insecurity and whether or not such a consequence is even avoidable? Ben?
I had not seen that research. My general view is that, you know, the closest thing we've seen recently to a large indiscriminate kind of shock hitting a lot of different commercial relationships was the COVID supply chain strain that basically, because I mean there were many things going on, but shipping being so strained made it just more unpredictable what was going to happen in any one of your sourcing relationships, how they were going to hold up, which of your suppliers might be experiencing some kind of strain, whether it be logistics or credit related or whatever. It caused a lot of kind of flickering in the whole network. And the reason, and we're beginning to understand that as economists, that when you hit a bunch of different links, it's kind of a different effect from just the usual things we analyze. Like if you can have a supply shock to a given kind of mineral, if a mine closes down, that's one thing. But if you have it throughout a network, it's not like shutting down one road. It's like making all the traffic lights in a city, in a big chunk of the city, start flickering on and off and not work. It's going to cause it. And I think that's the kind of thing we should be imagining. And we did see during COVID impacts, unpredictable impacts across consumer goods, prices going up. On the question of inflation, by the way, which came up earlier, I completely agree what the definition of inflation is. But I do think when people see prices rising in a bunch of different sectors, over the course of a few years, that normal people call that inflation. That economists don't like that, but that's what it feels like. And in many ways, the economics and politics of it is reasonably similar. Food prices, yeah, I'd expect vulnerable people to be more affected. I mean, everybody on this panel can probably absorb whatever grocery prices we experience. So I think that's bad. It's bad politics for Trump, which is a reason to hope that he might, that it is just a bargaining chip. But very quick thing on the geopolitics of it, I completely agree that policy should be used as a geopolitical weapon. I just think that, it should be used in a smart way. And I haven't heard an argument yet that this type of tariff has any geopolitical sense to it. If the argument is let's do something that's good geopolitics, I'm happy to accept that as the argument of the other side. I think it's a terrible argument.
Yeah, if I could say a few things about the geopolitics question too. Geopolitics obviously are relevant in the discussions. National security is relevant in the discussion for tariffs, but I think that there's a little bit of wanting it to have it both ways here. So obviously the most important geopolitical issue of our times is the economic and political aggression of China and Russia. And so you hear it said that we need tariffs because we've entered into a new Cold War. Okay, but how did we win the old Cold War? Okay, we did not win it by threatening Canada that if they don't become the 51st state, we're going to tariff them, right? We didn't win it by trying to bully Denmark, Greenland away from Denmark. Like, this is not, and you did not win it with a strategy that said our new face in the world is that everything must benefit the US. That's the only thing we care about. An America first centricness of global foreign policy. That's you cannot isolate Russia and China without soft power. And I see so many different ways that we are retreating from soft power and threatening our allies with tariffs and making demands that are already part of past agreements or are incoherent and insane, like become our 51st state, or are aimed at nonsensical economic goals like closing bilateral trade deficits. This is not good geopolitics. We need to be in an era of working with our allies, building supply chains that are with our allies, making sure that our leading national security industries are ahead of our opponents. And like this kind of, you know, blustery, fight your friends, make insane demands, threaten tariffs that undermine global value chains. This is the opposite of good geopolitics. Like if we are in a new Cold War, and I grant that that is possible, maybe even probable, like we should act like it and take it seriously and not get distracted by whether Canada's putting taxes on our milk. You know, like that's it reflects an taking the issue not very seriously. I don't think we should do that.
I would just say that, a lot of the partners that we trade with, including Mexico and Canada, have tariffs on the goods that go into the United States. So if it's not the right way to fight, you know, the Cold War or to treat allies, why do they treat us that way? So again, and here's the thing with me, like the reality is I don't really care what they do. I didn't vote for Trump and I wouldn't vote for Trump. But my job is not to pass judgment. My job is to figure out what the hell these idiots are going to do and what kind of impact it's going to have on the market and portfolios. And the reality is Trump is going to do these things. And so I think it's our job to figure out how that's going to affect things, what it's going to do to the markets. And so far, I have not seen anybody analyze what these types of things would do to the Canadian market or the Mexican market or the Russian market or the Chinese market. All I hear is how it's going to crush the US market, but it goes both ways. And so the idea that this is going to be uniquely bad for the United States and it's going to cause the United States to fall on the world stage as opposed to rise, that I think is not fact-based. I don't think that there's too much other than opinion to back that up. And I think it's way too early to say that it's not going to work. And so I would encourage people to keep an open mind on whether or not some of this is going to work. I don't know whether it's going to work or not. But what I do know is that for a long time, the U.S. has used its soft power. And, you know, that is unfortunately in some ways going out the window, and they are no longer going to only use soft power. The fact of the matter is they are going to use hard power. And, you know, I think the world kind of needs to wake up and get ready for it.
Now, to that end, actually, and Adam, I'll pass to you after Marco here for your secondary comments on that. In terms of, you know, the global arena, if we look back into history to the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, for example, It's been directly tied by myriad economists to a worsening of the Great Depression by triggering a global trade war. And this also caused a fairly dramatic drop, a straight-up decline in international trade as countries kind of retaliated with their own high tariffs, sharp decreases in exports, economic hardship worldwide is directly tied to that Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which allowed the president to raise or lower tariffs by, I think it was 50%. And so first, I'm curious, Marco, what kind of effect do you see something like this having on the global economy, on other countries that we haven't discussed, such as Mexico and Canada?
Well, I think it's actually true that this will not really benefit the U.S., but it will also not benefit Mexico or Canada or any other country if there are other tariffs that are introduced. Regarding this geopolitics, I think it's interesting to say that, for example, China that saw tariffs increase by, I mean, to 10% today, they're actually like, I think, kind of relieved because they thought that they were going to see 60% tariffs, because this was what was discussed during the campaign, and they prepared themselves to see 60%, and then they only got 10%. This could be something like, okay, China may see it like, okay, maybe Trump is better for us. Maybe we can form something here, like and this is not just based on my observation. Actually, I've seen Chinese people talk about these things. So this is kind of like they are happy because they didn't get higher tariffs, and this is in a sense a progress. Like they thought they were going to get tariffs, but tariffs are not as bad as they feared. So maybe this gets us somewhere. I think it's important for the global economy to work. It's important for the two major economies, the U.S. and then China, to have some kind of relationship. I mean, I don't know. It's obvious. Maybe Americans and Chinese are not going to really be fond of each other, but maybe they can cooperate. Maybe we can see the trade there, despite all of these things, and maybe there is some hope that something can get worked out in the future. We will see. But this is kind of like these things are something that usually gets missed when people talk about tariffs, because everyone is just seeing the 10%. But yeah, 10% is not as high as 60%. So this could be a token for the future here. I don't know. We'll see.
Thank you, Marco. So I know the situation I quoted pushing up on 100 years ago. So looking at more recent history now, the retaliatory tariffs during the U.S.-China trade war 2018 caused American farmers to lose over an estimated $27 billion in exports. And we're already kind of seeing something similar develop here with China's 10% tariff announcement on materials. Now, with similar, possibly more severe tariffs on the horizon, what strategies, if any, could be implemented to protect U.S. agricultural producers and maintain export stability despite potential strain with our trade partners and allies? I want to go to Yuri on this one and then kick it over to Adam.
That's a very interesting question. I think obviously the agricultural industry in the U.S. is quite a powerful industry in the sense that it's a reasonably big employer. It's has quite a lot of clout, and it's one of the key export industries. Obviously, the last time we saw Trump tariffs, there was you know, China's a big buyer of soybeans and other types of produce, American agricultural produce. I think America's also been trying to get their agricultural products into Europe. And so therefore there's a sort of, it's a key industry, and it also helps with the political domestic wins as well, right? If you can get farmers on side, you can cover large parts of the US as well. So I think it's an interesting area. And then of course we have all of the related industries around farming as well. But the reality is a lot of these goods are also moving between borders in North America. And it's a, like Canadian grain comes down to the US, US grain goes up to Canada. Again, it's as Ben was saying earlier, it's a complicated picture in terms of trade. But I think there are, so it forms part of the overall puzzle. And I agree that sometimes a lot of these policies can seem a little haphazard. And in many ways, they are just a way of getting people to the negotiating table, but already at a disadvantaged position. You know, when Scott Bessent, the current Treasury Secretary, was talking about his appointment, he was, you know, he used to refer to these tariffs and things as a loaded gun, and almost in many ways the gun needs to seem quite credible, and I think that's the situation we're in right now. I think many people look at the 2018 experience and say that was credible, but that was in the past. Industry got past it. The pain wasn't inflicted. Who knows how this will work? And I think what's sort of slightly concerning or something to think about is that the current administration has shown some ability to tolerate maybe lower stock markets or higher US dollar. You know, previously, Trump wasn't talking about these things to achieve some of these objectives by making this tariff threat credible. And the agricultural piece is going to be a part of it. I think there will be concessions for that particular industry. As you probably all remember, John Deere's manufacturing facility in Mexico, and that spat over construction of agricultural machinery as well. You know, things could start happening at the company level. And a lot of this is just threatening to get things done. And then, as I said, it kind of my opening remarks, it's almost like what's the constant that sits among all of this? Well, it's just promoting U.S. industry abroad. Agriculture is one of those bits, and promoting U.S. manufacturing and just basically telling foreign companies you got to build manufacturing plants. Now, I think companies will hear that threat, but a lot of what will happen will be the economic reality. And that's what I go back to. The economic reality for companies will be what will drive a renaissance in U.S. manufacturing. Government policy will come in and go. But right now we have this kind of interesting situation where there's a tolerance for a lot of pressure. Equally, you still have a lot of the subsidies from the major acts that were passed a couple of years ago. Here I'm talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, the IIJA, the CHIPS Act. All of the money is still flowing in. Nothing's really been revoked yet or moved around. And so you could have a situation where you have a double whammy in terms of policy. Some tariff protection uses a negotiating tool, some subsidies. You could see a very potential kind of resurgence of U.S. manufacturing reshoring in that sense. And so to answer your question specifically on agriculture, I think that will be a piece of it in terms of specific policies that will face it. It's complicated, right? Because agriculture is important. It feeds into a lot of the groceries, and you have to just be careful about the impact on the fund on the voting base, which is lower income, lives paycheck to paycheck, is quite sensitive to the price of goods. And so if those get influenced, there could be potential flashback. And I think it's about understanding how much domestic pain is going to be tolerated to achieve some of these other objectives.
Beautifully said, Yuri. Thank you. Adam, do you have anything to add to Yuri's points there?
Yeah, I think that's right, that agriculture is at risk here. And in the last Trump tariffs, we ended up subsidizing soybean producers by over $10 billion. And I think it really highlights one of the core inconsistencies in the policy argument for tariffs. you hear on the one hand that, well, this is essential to reindustrializing in the US and onshoring, and we need to be able to have enough industrial capacity to fight war with China. And, you know, it's a real focus on the reshoring industrial capacity, questions like that. But then the rubber hits the road and Trump goes to negotiate with China and he demands they import soybeans. And I think we have to be very, very careful about imputing these sort of, 12-dimensional chess moves on the administration's trade policy, when it's really like it's not aiming for those things. Like one of the previous discussants said, well, you know, we just want other countries to lower their trade barriers. That's not really what he's asking for. I mean, that's not really what's happening here. You hear me? He loves tariffs. He wants tariffs in place. And to the extent that he's funding particular industries, it often ends up being agriculture. I won't deny that there's a possibility that tariffs can play a role in some sort of industrial policy aimed at, you know, strategic outcomes, but you have to have a plan, and the plan has to be coherent, and you have to think strategically, and you have to work with allies. And that's just not what we're getting. And so, and to address one of the people responding in the comments, you know, this isn't a partisan issue. Like, yes, I'm criticizing the administration's approach here, but you can levy a lot of complaints about the Biden administration as well. I mean, what their decision to block U.S. steel purchase from Nippon Steel, the Chinese steel manufacturing plant, is the same kind of incoherence, same kind of absurdity. So, like, we have a protectionist turn in this country, both sides of the aisle. My point here is not to attack any one party or the other. My point here is to attack the protectionism itself, whoever's doing it, and to demand that if you're going to do this, you must understand that it is very difficult. It is very difficult. Even in the most optimistic cases where you can point to instances in history when perhaps tariffs played a role as part of one country and another's successful industrial policy, it was very, very carefully done. It was took trade-offs into consideration, and it was done very surgically with a core, clear strategy in mind. And this three-card Monty game where, oh, well, the tariff's about this. Actually, it's about this. Well, actually, we want this. No, in this case, that's not the kind of strategy that's going to lead to success. It's going to lead to failure, just like the first round of tariffs did. They led to more layoffs in manufacturing because of raising costs on downstream producers than they gained in the steel and aluminum industries themselves. Like, that's what's going to happen here. It's not going to be good for these core strategic goals. So I think people who see themselves as proponents of protectionism as a large component of industrial policy, they're the ones who need to work harder at criticizing when the policy is used in an incoherent, counterproductive way. And so, again, not a partisan issue. This is about criticizing protectionism.
So on that note, another critique of kind of the situation as a whole is that in some ways, these negotiations, if you care to refer to them as such, kind of follow more of a distributive approach where, you know, one entity needs to claim the most of some resource, needs to have a win-loss scenario between those involved, rather than the way the global structure functions now, which is more integrative, referring to more of a collaborative approach where there's a win-win scenario of some sort for both entities. And so, Ben, I'm curious, what do you think about that critique, and what type of strategy do you think would be much more mutually beneficial for the U.S. trade partners and any other country that may be affected economically by such a trade war?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do want to, there's something Noah Smith wrote, that really stuck with me, which is that after watching him for a long time, Noah decided that Trump is probably a sincere mercantilist. Like, he actually has, for someone who can often seem, you know, opportunistic or very flexible in what seems good, it does seem like going back to the 80s, he actually thinks of trade in terms of who is winning from this and who is losing. And he thinks of tariffs as a way to make yourself win more. And what's kind of interesting is actually in classical trade theory, the kind that you would learn in like a good undergraduate economics degree, there's a way in which that's sort of true, that if you have the distortions of tariffs are when you have like a very textbook toy economy, which nobody believes is really the case. But if you have like an undistorted competitive market and then you impose a little tariff, the effects on surplus are not second order. They're very small, and it does shift surplus within, among different interest groups. And maybe that's not such a big deal. That's as you said, like a plus, someone wins, somebody loses. Maybe your domestic industry wins and their industry loses a little bit for a while, and your consumers are willing to bear some of that pain. So that's sort of the old politics of tariffs. I think what it completely misses is in these ultra integrated supply chains, especially in industries like biotech, robotics, certainly, anything having to do with chips and the AI industry, is just a world that we don't really have experience with, because it's only become, in the last 30 years, it's become a radically different world in terms of the complexity of those connections. And so I feel like, for what I'm in, like from the perspective of a reshoring ETF, for example, what's kind of interesting is I agree that businesses respond to the economics. I agree in the long run, they're going to try to diversify and multi-source and get the US, their US operations much more robust. But what's the economics of it over a 10-year time span? I think a lot of that is basically, where in the world are you betting that a robust ecosystem capable of sort of, fostering a flourishing internal, a flourishing dense ecosystem of many different kinds of firms working together freely, where is that going to happen? I think we should be looking at that. It's by no means the sort of story of U.S. economic decline, secular decline in leadership in some things, says that it's not a foregone conclusion that it's going to be the U.S., and so I feel like that's the geopolitics of it is find the allies that we feel we really need to make that work. And make sure that even though we have less unitary politics than China, find a way that we can have a coherent vision over a 10-year time span to build that kind of leadership where any reasonable business knows it needs the U.S. not just as a consumer market, but also as the center of a big, complex production, manufacturing, whatever you want to call it, economy. And I feel like actually I do appreciate some of Trump's rhetoric and that it makes people feel like the US is not going to necessarily sit pretty with that, forever. But the way it's a very precious thing that we can really lose. And I think basically figuring out how we can make bigger, more robust, and more supported free trade zones with smart strategic support for security related things. So security related supply chains, I think, have to be handled differently, and smart policy needs to really put that first and kind of carve that out. But as Adam was saying, we need to do that at like a very high level of strategic chess, and not, a kind of blunt tool to kind of try to get a few dollars from your neighbor because he's scared. I think that's kind of that zero sum way of thinking is really stopping us from having the smart 10-20 year strategy.
So Yuri, one comment there in terms of that more long-term strategizing, How does that look from your point of view in the management of a reshoring ETF, kind of planning ahead? I know RSHO is up something like 51% since inception, and I know that we're seeing more of that trend of companies reshoring and manufacturing here in the States. How does that translate to more of a long-term point of view?
I mean, this is really interesting. A lot of the times, there's a couple of bits to kind of unpick here. I think the first way that RSHO is kind of looking at this is sort of positioning between kind of three different groups of companies. So first, you have a group that we call the reshoring facilitators, and this is the majority of the portfolio. I mean, just I think over last I checked, 52-53% of the portfolio, and these are the businesses that are helping companies build manufacturing in the US. And when I say manufacturing, I use that term very broadly. So someone mentioned healthcare, but that includes that as well. It includes all kinds of future-proofed industries, and I think that's one of the things that people maybe don't give the Biden administration, and these were bipartisan acts that were passed in the US, but they were all about future-proofed industries, not competing in some of the older industries, let's say steel, but more competing in electric vehicles, batteries, semiconductors. Healthcare is another part that I think is going through the Senate currently as an area of focus. And it's about building resilience for US domestic production, but also export prowess, which will hopefully come afterwards if you build enough supply, and of course it has to be competitive supply, which is still a question mark. And the reality is that the fund is focused on the companies that are building up, plus the infrastructure that goes with it. The infrastructure is something that really needs to be upgraded in the US. The Association of Civil Engineers, until last year, was consistently giving America kind of a CD kind of grade for the state of infrastructure. And here I'm talking electricity grid, waterways, roads, all of that kind of stuff. And that needs to be upgraded. And that's what the companies are telling the governments and states as well. Like, we'll build these manufacturing facilities, but you need to be able to provide the necessary parts. And some of these will be private and some of them will be public. And it goes across those industries. And then you have what we call reshoring beneficiaries. And these are the businesses that are, we know will broadly benefit from more industrial production activity in the US. The more industrial activity there is, the more, for example, there'll be hazardous waste, and there will need to be companies that do hazardous waste disposal. And this goes on to my point about long-term, how these companies will get transformed. This is a corner of the market. And I think it's one of the reasons why RSHO companies are up is a corner of the market that has just been left behind because of other excitements. But it's a corner of the market that's starting to see growth because of this reshoring trend. And as we know, the stock market will reward growth over the long run for these companies. And so we're seeing businesses that previously said, yeah, we don't really grow, or we grow like a little bit, or we're very cyclical, transform into getting some structural growth, and they're going to be getting re-rated in the marketplace. The reality is, if you looked up a chart, and we have this chart, if anyone wants it, can message me, I'll send it over. If you look at GDP growth, consumption, and industrial production in America, GDP growth and consumption, industrial production, until about 2000, all grew together at the same structural rate. After 2000, which happened to be the year China entered WTO, industrial production basically flatlined in America, and it started to be volatile and cyclical. GDP and consumption continued to grow. And so what we're maybe going to see is, and it depends whether it's a confluence of these policies or companies doing it, a recoupling of industrial production growth with structurally with GDP and consumption, which could lead to a re-rating of some of these companies over the long run. A smaller portion, funnily enough, and we've been talking about this, is actually companies moving manufacturing to the US. And that's a smaller part of the fund. They gain an advantage, but as many of the speakers have identified, that advantage is unclear just yet how that's going to look. And so we'd rather be the one there with the companies that are building some of these facilities and thinking about the future than maybe taking outsized bets on companies that are going to gain an advantage. It is unclear yet whether reshoring to the US is going to give you an advantage, but we think it will over time if you have this, as Ben was saying, or someone was saying earlier, kind of confluence of government, business, investments, and rebuilding. It's very, very important. I think someone else earlier said, where we've come from. America has shed millions of manufacturing jobs. It has ceded quite a lot of manufacturing share globally. I think we've gone from 26% of global manufacturing share back in 2000 to something like 16% now. Now, the economists will say that's because it's a consumption economy and it's about where the most efficient production is. And actually, it makes the economy richer. But I think the reality is that probably that has swung too far. And there is a world that you can see where this can be engineered back, whether it's through policy or whether it's through companies doing that or just forcing companies to build that. And so where we're trying to position the fund is how the reshoring trend will evolve over time and reshape that economy outside of these sectoral and geographic lines. You want to be in the companies that are helping build infrastructure and manufacturing early on. And then you want to transition to companies that are going to benefit from that, as well as possibly the relative winners there. So we will see how it goes out. But I think this it's kind of unprecedented in America that at the same time you have trade policy being used as a tool, and you have all of the subsidies from the major acts that were passed with bipartisan support all happening at the same time, and companies responding to what was one of the most profound supply chain shocks that the world has witnessed really in the last 30 years, which was COVID. And if you look at all of these supply chain risk metrics, and you can see them from KPMG and others, they've all reset at a much higher level. And that is the reality businesses face today. And so that's why we're so convinced that this trend will last for quite a long time, because it's reshaping how this works. And then you start to talk about moving into other sectors. Again, someone did mention healthcare. To me, that's one of the most interesting places. now 90 or 80% of U.S. active pharmaceutical ingredients in generics have no U.S. source. So they're all imported. And that, I think, could be a risk. And so there needs to be a building of manufacturing base in the U.S. for active pharmaceutical ingredients. It's a high technology industry. It's unclear why the cost base shouldn't be that different. And then just one final point on cost. There's a great analysis being done on the total cost of ownership of manufacturing. Now, it's a highly speculative exercise. But if you start to think about modern automation tools, if you start to think about future cost reductions, you can kind of see where U.S. industry can become competitive, especially if it's in the future-proofed industries. And that's really where we're positioning the fund. Beneficiaries first, facilitators first, building this new manufacturing base, the beneficiaries that will benefit from that, and selectively looking at manufacturing. And by the way, some of these companies overlap. You know, they'll be providing the goods and materials to build factories, but they might be also moving their manufacturing closer to those customers as they get built. I just go back for everyone here is that we can discuss policy as much as we like, but the reality is we're day to day, I'm seeing companies doing this. And to me as an investor, these trends, when a business and a private sector is doing it, are just much more long-term and long-lived than trying to invest behind government policy.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it and a good place to close us out here, Yuri. Before we send all of these fine folks off into the ether, where can they see more details on RSHO and some of the publications that y'all are doing over at TAMA?
First of all, thanks so much for hosting this. I think it's a very important topic to understand for investors at large, especially as it's redrawing kind of the U.S. economy. So I just wanted to thank all of the speakers for their very, very insightful contributions. I've certainly have taken quite a lot of notes today. I think for people who are interested in the RSHO fund, you can head to the TEMA's website. So it's TEMAETFs.com. And there under insights, you can read lots of articles that we've written both about nearshoring, about various trends, you know, how this is more than just infrastructure, what all these things mean. We have an article coming out next week about tariffs and Trump. So do sign up to the newsletter. We'll be sending it out through that as well. And you can find out more about the fund on the website as well. There's a fact sheet to download about the kinds of companies that we're investing in. This fund is managed by someone who's been through many, many different market cycles and has seen government policy come and go. And is just close to the companies and spends a lot of time going and seeing them on the ground. And that's the other thing I would encourage people to read. We have an article about what's going on at the different state level. Sometimes for people, you need to really just go and see what is being built in states like Indiana, Texas, Arizona. It really is a transformation of many of those things. TSMC are building a $65 billion chip facility in Arizona in the desert. It's quite spectacular what is being put down. So we write about all of this stuff and we'll be doing more of that as we go and see companies throughout the year. So www.temaetfs.com, and you can check out the RSHO fund. The ticker is RSHO, and you can find it in all of your brokerage apps if you're interested in looking at that.
Beautiful. Thank you, Yuri. And thank you again to every single speaker, Ben, Marco, Brent, Adam, of course, Yuri. This was a really, really good discussion. I think I learned more on this tariff ETF than I knew about tariffs to begin with. So it was really great having everybody's point of view today for everybody to learn more. Follow everybody up here, folks, if you're not already. Constant publications coming out of all of these panelists, constant review and macroeconomic analysis from everybody up here. I learned a lot from all of these folks. I obviously learned a ton today. If you came in late or missed anything, don't worry about it. This will be published later today as an Unusual Whales podcast episode on Apple and Spotify. Thanks again to TAMA ETFs and, of course, to Yuri for being here, giving his expertise along with every panelist we've had today. Have a great rest of your day, everybody, and thanks for kicking it with us for the last hour or so.